shooting from the lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, shooting from the lip.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Shooting From The Lip with me, John Gaunt. Got a great guest for you today. This man always shoots from his lip. It's the research economist and, of course, leading Brexiteer for the last 20 or so odd years. His name is Godfrey Bloom and he joins me now.
Shooting From The Lip.
Hi, Godfrey.
Morning, good morning.
Good morning, great to have you here. John McDonnell yesterday at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, they do like having comedians, and there's no bigger joker than him. He says, if Boris pushes through a no deal and defies Parliament, he will send Jeremy Corbyn off to see the Queen. Some people are saying this is a coup. What do you think?
Well, it's rather amusing. It is totally apt, isn't it, that it's at the Edinburgh Fringe where you get all your lunatics at midnight, all smoking wacky backy and all sorts of carry-on. Yeah, I mean, that's just completely ludicrous because everything's been passed legally now to leave. We're leaving. That's the default position, that we leave in October. That is the default position. Parliament had its say. Parliament gave us a referendum. The promise was to abide by it. Everybody went to the country, every party went to the country on that manifesto. They passed the legislation that needed for us to withdraw. They triggered Article 50, so on and so forth. All that's been done. So Parliament's role in this entire thing is now over. It's finished. They have no part to play.
Sure.
We must now leave and be done with it.
Also, should he be putting the Queen in that position, or would the Queen give him short notice?
She wouldn't see him. There's no constitutional precedent to see the Prime Minister of the day. She is obliged to see, but she's not obliged to see anyone else, and least of all an opposition joker like those comedians. No, she doesn't have to see them. She won't see them. She's constitutionally not able to see them.
Okay.
It would be a breach of her constitutional role if she were to see them. What used to happen in the old days, and of course, what would have happened when there was a vote of no confidence in the government, or the government was defeated, if you go back to the days of Pitt or Lord Salisbury or Disraeli or Gladstone, and historically Parliament, if the government of the day lost, if they lost a vote, they would then go to the country. And that's what Theresa May should have done when she had overwhelmingly defeated her withdrawal agreement. She should have gone to the country. All that's passed now. Boris Johnson must take us out. The Prime Minister must take us out. And then I suspect when he's taken us out, he must then go to the country, and I suspect he will.
What do you say to people who say, well, hold on a minute, Parliament has been defying the public for the last 3 years. They were given a clear instruction when we had that vote. They should have just got on with it.
Well, that's absolutely right. And what if I were Boris, what I would do is I would take us out, which he's capable of doing because all the legislation has been passed to do. He can take us out. And then the people in his own party that stab him in the back, the people, the Dominic Greaves of this world, all those sorts of people, all those fifth columnists, he can withdraw the whip, which means when he goes to the country, those people will not be able to wear a blue label. And both you and I and your listeners know, John, that these people are unelectable without their label. If they didn't wear a blue or red rosette, they wouldn't get any votes at all. And they know that. And so consequently, if they have to go back to their constituencies, stand as independent or Liberal Democrats, they will almost certainly lose their seats. So Boris actually has all the cards. What he needs to make sure he doesn't do, he mustn't blink. He's got all the cards. He's got a strong hand. He's got the country behind him. 17.4 million, and a lot of Remainers now have said, let's get on with it, even though they voted Remain. So the country's behind him, and he must get on and do it.
So how do you think he's played it in these first few weeks? Do you think he's playing a blinder? Has he made any mistakes? Do you think he should have the optimism, and we should share his optimism now? Is he going to be a good PM?
I think he's done very well. He said all the right things. I thought he made some very good speeches, and he's saying all the right things. So I'm very encouraged. We should have had a Prime Minister saying these things years ago. Confidence, you shouldn't be. My view, John, is that you shouldn't be. If you don't have faith in the country, if you don't believe the country is capable of governing itself in an independent way, you shouldn't be in public office. And so these people, these ministers who believe that we can't govern ourselves, Hammond and all those sort of people, they shouldn't be in public office. Nobody should be in public office. And you shouldn't be the manager of a football team if you have no confidence it can win a game.
Absolutely. That's a great analogy. Well, let's talk about the international scene then. Do you think the way he's playing the EU is correct, refusing to go to see them, making them come to the table? And will he succeed? Will there be a deal?
Well, they've said, credit where credit is due to the European Union, I think, and we need to be fair to them. They have said there is no deal. There is no deal. The withdrawal agreement from Theresa May wasn't a deal. That was a surrender document, as we all know, and which nobody was going to pass, and it was defeated three times. So consequently, there is no deal. They've said there's no deal. They've been totally honest and upfront. There's no deal. So what we need to say, OK, there's no deal, then we're going to get about leaving. We'll leave under WTO rules, and then we will negotiate globally whatever trade transactions or trade agreements that we feel that we can. And of course, with a 95 billion trade deficit in the European Union's favour, they will come to the table very, very quickly because they haven't had any pressure from their own institutions and corporations thus far. It's all been one-way traffic. But when BMW, Peugeot, Mercedes and Volkswagen and Siemens and all these people will have to then visit their politicians and say, these are our biggest customers. Are you mad? We have to do a deal. They're the ones that need a deal. Only 8% of our GDP goes in exports to the EU. Listening to your programme today, there won't be more than one person, probably in 500, who has, if they're in the United Kingdom, have anything to do with exporting or selling anything to the European Union. It's a tiny bit of our entire economy, and that's what people don't seem to realise. But of course, we all know that this isn't about trade. It's never been about trade. It's about a centralised United States of Europe with one government, one leader, one anthem, control from Brussels.
Absolutely.
That's what they actually want. This has nothing to do with trade. The trade is a complete red herring.
OK, but let me just see from your experience of economics as well here. So you think we will leave on October the 31st, or as the BBC calls it, crash out. We don't give them the 39 billion, but then they'll come back to us and want to do a deal going forward as we do deals with Australia and the United States of America. Is that how you see it playing out?
I think it has to play out that way. But what we also need to bear in mind, and I'm going to put my sort of research economist hat on for just a moment here, trade deals aren't really as important as people think they are. Our biggest export market, a single sovereign country, is America. We have no trade agreement.
Mm-hmm.
We have no formal trade agreement with the United States of America, and they're our biggest customer. We have no trade agreement with China. You try and buy anything that wasn't made in China, John. You try and buy a deck chair or a garden
table,
or a new phone. It's all China. We don't have any deals with China. So again, this trade deal business is something of a red herring.
Do you think, though, for Boris to survive, and when it goes, obviously you're predicting a general election, some people are saying it's going to be the day after we leave. If we do have a general election, does he need your old pal, your old flatmate, Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party? Or are the Brexit Party now effectively finished because of the Boris factor?
Well, yes. I mean, if Boris goes to the country in November, I don't think he will. I think that would be too early. I would argue springtime, probably, but that's anybody's guess. If he's taken us out under WTO terms, there is no role for the Brexit Party to play. It's over. It's over for the Brexit Party if we leave. So there would be no point in it.
OK. So as long as we get out, the Brexit Party's finished. What does that mean for Nigel? Do you think there's any chance he's going to get elevated, which we all know that's what he wants, or into the Lords, or indeed to become US ambassador? What's your view on that? And would he make a good job of that?
Well, I would argue that, and what we've seen, where we've seen diplomacy fail around the globe is when our diplomats become too heavily politicised. And that was a problem with the previous chap, Darroch, in America. He was a political animal with a rather fake diplomatic hat on. He was a politico, and of course he's fallen out big time and damaged our relationship with the White House because of his stupidity and arrogance and incompetence. So I would argue, let's get back to having a proper career diplomat, not a Tony Blair mate or anybody else from anywhere else. Let's have a real professional diplomat who understands diplomacy and understands the United States in some depth. And I would argue the same with Russia and the same with anywhere else.
Okay, but many people say, well, Nigel Farage gets on so well with Trump. He knows how to play him. He could be a very useful figure. You don't buy that?
No, I don't buy that. What I do think, I'm not suggesting there isn't a role for Nigel to play. Certainly, I think if there was a trade delegation or something like that, I think it would be wise to put Nigel Farage on the team of a trade delegation and give him that knighthood or peerage that he so desperately craves. I would do that. I think credit where credit is due. And I think if he accompanied a trade delegation on Brexit, I think with a knighthood, I would argue, I think that would be satisfaction all round.
Okay, just before we leave the EU and the EU discussion, let's just quickly go back. The Irish backstop, is that all a load of nonsense, Godfrey?
Yes, of course it is. It's really quite laughable, isn't it? You've got the Irish government who've pledged faithfully that they will never build a border. The British have pledged that they will never build a border. And they've said they won't build a border in Brussels. So who's going to build this magical border, one wonders? And of course, as an old soldier, I know that part of the world. And I can tell you, you can't enforce a border there anyway. Most of it's water. Most of it's water on one side and the locks internally. And some very desolate places along that Ulster border. You know, it was a terrible job trying to police it in the Troubles when you had armed soldiers, thousands of armed soldiers all along the border. You couldn't really do it, so you certainly can't do it. No, it's an absolute nonsense. It's a laughable nonsense.
So has Viduca overplayed his hand, in your opinion, and are Ireland going to be losers in all this?
Well, we are the biggest customer. We are the Ireland's biggest customer. And of course, while I love to go on holiday and drink Guinness in Ireland, I have lots of Irish friends. They're coming to stay this weekend, lovely people. But as far as economics and politics is concerned, they're Mickey Mouse. I mean, they don't register. It's like Beverly Town playing bloody Liverpool. I mean, it's ridiculous. it's basically a rural economy, and it's a very nice place to be. But they don't register on the Richter scale. And if they lose us as a customer, they're going to be in terrible trouble. And they're beginning to wake up to that now, the Irish. They're beginning to ask their prime minister and their politician, they say, what the hell are you doing? These are our biggest customers and you're pissing them off.
Okay, let's have a quick chat now about the situation going forward. What should be Boris Johnson's priorities after getting us out of the EU?
Well, I think he needs to turn. There's lots of things he needs to start doing. He needs to return to the sort of Conservative Party that was run by Lord Salisbury, one of the most successful Conservatives administrations, which they've drifted away from over the last 20 years. He needs to get back to the concept of conservatism is the role of the family, low taxation, low regulation to free up the economy. We're now the highest, we're the highest tax bill now in 50 years, which is quite extraordinary under a Conservative administration of nearly 10 years. He needs to get back to grassroots. He needs to get back to proper policing. And I don't mean police prancing about in gay pride marches. How disgusting was that? I don't know whether you saw the clips.
I did see it. And also, what about the assistant chief constable with the spiky hair, the female, who they're now saying it's sexist because people have remarked on her punk haircut? The world's gone mad, Godfrey.
Well, Boris has got to, well, he's talking blithely about another 20,000 policemen, but what kind of policemen do we want? I don't want another 20,000 spiky-haired, dancing, prancing, made-up tossers like that. I want real policemen, old-fashioned policemen, on the beat, doing the right job, not these politically correct, common-purpose nutcases that we seem to have got. All the decent police have left. I mean, how embarrassing. If you're old-school police and you're watching that kind of demonstration, those kind of marches that are going on, you'd be ashamed to tell your children you're a policeman.
Yeah, but the argument is you've got to be inclusive, and that's why they paint the cars rainbow colours today, that they're looking after the gay, lesbian and trans community as well. You don't buy that?
No, I don't. What people do, and I'm a libertarian, and I believe what people do in the privacy of their own bedroom is entirely their own business. If it's by mutual consent, it doesn't matter to me how perverse or degrading any act that they might perform. I'm a libertarian. Do what you like. But if you are a police service being paid by the public, were they on wages to prance about like that in uniform? That is simply unacceptable to most inclusive. Let's include all the people that pay their salaries. Let's include them, shall we? We seem to be the ones, ordinary Middle England seem to be the people that are shut out.
Godfrey Bloom, thank you for that. Godfrey's shooting from the lip already, and he'll be back with more opinions just after this little break. Don't dare go away. You're listening to John Gaunt. It's Shooting from the Lip with my special guest today, Godfrey Bloom on Sputnik International.
Shooting from the Lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt. Shooting from the Lip.
Okay, welcome back. Second half, he's already started. Some very brilliant one-liners there, Godfrey. But let's just move that on. You're talking about the police, but for Boris to use these 20,000 officers and for anything to change, we also need to look at the criminal justice system, don't we? Both sentencing and indeed our prisons. What do you say?
Yes, indeed. We have a problem with the prisons to start with. And I did some research on this for an article I wrote a little while ago on prisons. And I spoke to the chaplain at Peterborough, Nick. And I've spoken to other prison officers, some of whom I count amongst my personal friends. And it's quite clear to me, and it's clear to them, that probably two-thirds of the people who are in prison shouldn't be there. They're the flotsam and jetsam of society, and there's nowhere else to really put them. So most of the people taking up places in our prisons shouldn't be there, and the people that should be in prisons, we let out. Now, I rather like the American system of three strikes and out. We have recidivist criminals who go on and on and on offending. They're let out, they offend. They're banged up again, they let out, offend. These people can't be let out. You have to, if it's a third offence, and these guys are beyond reform, you have to chuck the key away and use those resources to keep the first offender, try and get resources to stop people taking to a life of crime. That starts in the schools, and that starts with helping first offenders. And that would be a much better use of resources. We fritter away resources at the moment. The Crown Prosecution Service was highly politicised, and the problem is the judicial system's been politicised, and we can thank Tony Blair for a lot of that. We now have people on the bench who are politically correct judges appointed, you know, years ago under the Blair regime or influenced by the Blair regime. And so we have to get back to that. We also have to get back to the principles of English law. The principles of English law are a shield to the citizen. It's a shield. At the moment, the law is used to beat the citizen over the head. You know, and you don't get proper justice. You don't get trial by your peers. You go to a magistrate's court. 90% of these things go to a magistrate's court. Bang, bang, you're guilty, because the magistrate on the bench doesn't believe police ever lie. It's like quite ludicrous. So we've got to get back our principles of English law.
Let me just get that clear then. So you would end up sending less people to prison, but people who are serial offenders, they would eventually go down on a three strikes and you're out rule. Is that correct?
That's right.
Would the overall prison population decline then?
I think it would. But what you'd also need to do with the resources that you save, because keeping people in prison, as you know, is extremely expensive, but you have to transfer those resources to a more positive approach to people who have sort of slipped through the net, as it were, who aren't recidivist criminals. And we need, and along with that, of course, we need drug reform. We've got to get drug reform. I mean, the whole problem of this so-called war on drugs, which is failing. And so you're turning people into criminals, maybe for having half a kilo of dope under the seat of their car or something like that. We've got so much to do. We've got so much to do.
Tell me what your views are on drugs then. Would you decriminalise or legalise the lot? What would you do?
Well, I'd decriminalise most of them because clearly the system we have at the moment, you might as well, for drug addiction, you might as well criminalise flu. It doesn't make any sense. If people are addicted to drugs, what actually happens is when you decriminalise, when you make it a criminal offence, it pushes the price of the drugs up on the street. And they found this in 1920s prohibition in America. What it does is actually makes drugs more expensive. And your addict can't afford the drugs because they're too expensive. So he turns to crime to feed his habit, which means that your grandma has been bashed over the head for 10 quid or a pension book by some drug addict because the cost of drugs is so high, it becomes prohibitive and they must turn to crime. So we need to face it a completely different direction.
So would this actually then lead to less knife crime, for example, in London and in our major cities, and in terms of this, what do they call it, county lines drug dealing? Is this one way to counter that? I mean, obviously the other obstacle is Sadiq Khan, but your views?
Yes. I mean, What happens when you criminalise something, whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever it happens to be, what you do is you institutionalise crime. And so who are the role models on these big council estates? The role models, who's driving the BMW? Who's got money in his pocket? It's the drug pushers and the drug dealers. So they are a role model for these sink estates. Now, if you want to get rid of drug dealers, you decriminalize drugs. You do not need the brains of an archbishop to work this one out. But of course, everybody's they've all got their finger in the pie. And of course, it's the old adage, isn't it? You've got the preacher and the bootlegger. You know, this analogy of the preacher and the bootlegger. Mm. The preacher wants alcohol banned on principle because he's a preacher and a clergyman. And your bootlegger wants it banned because he's making a very, very good living indeed because it has been criminalised. So who does not want it decriminalised? Your drug dealer. It's the worst thing that could happen to them because they lose their livelihood.
But if you decriminalise it, where do you buy the drugs from? Are you suggesting you could buy joints? Are you suggesting you could go to the chemist and get some cocaine or you could get some heroin? Is that how does it work? I understand the libertarian argument, but how would it practically work?
Well, Canada's has experimented with this, and some states in America, Colorado, Portugal and Holland have systems, and at the moment they're all work. Some of them are working well and some of them not so well. But what you do is if you treat it in much the same way as you do any other drug, you know, alcohol, which is just a form of drug.
Yeah, sure.
Cigarettes, just a form of drug. So what you do is that you legalize it and you and sell it in the appropriate way like you do alcohol under controlled circumstances.
And that would lead to a reduction in use, do you feel?
I'm not suggesting it would lead to a reduction in use, but what it would do automatically is lead to a reduction in crime. And what we're after here, ordinary people going about their business, want to see a reduction in crime.
Fully understand that. So let's look at Sadiq Khan and so-called Stab City and in London. How do you deal with these people, these gangs who just seem to be running amok? I mean, often just killing other gang members, but a murder is a murder. What are we going to do about that?
Well, we've seeded the streets, haven't we, now, in many of these big cities. And you will ask any London cabbie, he'll tell you the areas where they will not go. London cabbies will not go. And we've seen the police will not go in there. And consequently, you have these enclaves in big cities which are not policed and they're run by the gangs. So the streets have been handed over to the criminals and the gangsters. And if you look at some of our senior policemen and women, you can see why. They're sitting. We have police, 500 policemen apparently in London, sitting watching the screens to make sure that Godfrey Bloom doesn't say something nasty about Alibaba Brown. That is not the way we need to be policed.
So 20,000 extra coppers won't make a blind bit of difference unless there's an attitudinal change in government and in policing and in the courts. Yeah.
Complete waste of time, and it's the same with the national health. You see, Boris has said, oh, here's another billion or something like that, but no hint of reform. It's reform that is needed. If you look at the number of police per capita, it isn't that far away historically from what it's ever been. It's also not that far away from other big cities in America. Now, as you know, if you walk the length of Central Park, up to through into Manhattan and past the hotels, you'll find a cop, a New York cop, on every street corner. I walked the other day from my club in St. James's to Trafalgar Square back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I didn't see a single cop on the beat, not one. They've got to be on the beat. And of course, we have policemen now who are in charge who aren't real policemen at all. They're political appointees. Cressida Dick is a political appointee. She's gone from one bungled operation to the next. She's utterly hopeless. And she's running London.
And what do you think of Priti Patel running the Home Office?
Well, she's talked a good story in the past. I've got a bit of time for her. I think she needs a fair crack of the whip, and she's going to need support because the first people that will stab her in the back will be the BBC, the politically correct BBC, the politically correct Channel 4. They will have their knives out for her for day one. But what we need and what we haven't had for probably 25 years now is a really tough Home Secretary who's genuinely tough. And she's also going to get on the phone to the chief constables of these cities where policemen are prancing around in makeup and say, right, you're sacked, You're all sacked. We've got a whole new broom sweeping clean here. We're going to have go back to some real policing.
OK, when you got that new broom, shall we get rid of the police crime commissioners, whatever they're called? Are they worth anything?
Well, you know, this is a tragedy because the idea itself is very good. It meant that people could vote and everybody could vote for somebody who could stop this silly nonsense and misuse of police and get police back on the beat, because that police commissioner would actually recruit a policeman, an assistant chief constable, to do just that. Now, it was politicised. This was never the idea. So you get Labour and Conservative police commissioners. We've got back to this two-party system again. So what now, your police commissioners in Sheffield and places like that are utterly hopeless, and they recruit in their own image utterly hopeless constables. The theory itself was actually quite good.
OK, let's just move on, if we can, before we finish in a few minutes. Let's talk about Donald Trump. What do you make of these mass shootings and the reaction by him and the reaction of people to him, many people saying it's his words, his terminology, that led to this? Now, it kind of doesn't add up with the Ohio one, because he was an Antifa lefty sympathiser. Your views?
Well, yes, you're quite right. You've put your finger right on the nub of it, John, there. We've ignored the Ohio one because it doesn't fit, it doesn't come out of the right pigeonhole, does it? So we're only concentrating on the Texas one. Yes, these mass shootings have been a problem in America for many years. It's got nothing to do with Trump. And of course, if you look at the numbers, if you want to break it down by skin color, which I hate doing because I think it's meaningless, but you'll find that the vast majority of mass killings are carried out by blacks, followed by Hispanics, followed by white. If you want to play the color game.
And also, of course, there were more massacres during Obama than there has been during Trump's reign. So it's not like it's just Trump. And do you actually buy the kind of causal effect that if you say that things he said about immigration and border control, that it can lead to nutcases, extremists, doing things like this in El Paso?
Well, no, I don't, actually. I think what is more dangerous, if people ignore the will of the people or the feeling of the people, we have strong feelings about immigration, people think that too many people are coming into the country. We have that problem in this country, where we have the equivalent of the population in Cardiff coming in every year, 350,000. That doesn't even count the illegals, which we don't even know about. So people feel frustrated and they feel unrepresented on these matters. And I think where you get your problem is if people feel unrepresented in these matters, that's where it could trigger violence. I think that's your danger point.
And you mentioned and alluded to the BBC earlier about policing and about crime and about drugs and about Brexit. I mean, what do you think about the BBC now and their coverage? And indeed, most of the mainstream broadcasters, are you very angry about it? I mean, is it time for the licence fee to go? What do you make of it?
Well, it's a complete anachronism, isn't it? I mean, there are over 100 TV channels, Freeview, I think, or somewhere near 100 that you can watch. But if we don't watch the state-sponsored BBC, they send a thug round to take your furniture away or take your house away or put you in prison. How can we call ourselves a free society where you have to subscribe to a state broadcasting system? I mean, that's really straight out of the Soviet Union, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, I'd have to agree with you. Godfrey, it's been brilliant talking to you. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time. Godfrey Bloom, the economist and, of course, the leading Brexiteer over the last 20 or so years. My name's John Gaunt. It's Shooting from the Lip on Sputnik International. I'll be back next week with another guest who'll be just as forthright as Godfrey. Thanks for listening.
Shooting from the Lip.
If you've got a view, I want to hear it. If you agree, I want to hear it. If you disagree, get in touch. Tell me why I'm wrong, but you better have a good argument.
This is Shooting from the Lip.